My Life as an Animal, Serialization, Week 9. This episode is brought to you by animalaid.org.uk, who campaign peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promote cruelty-free living.
It's now time to continue our audiobook here on UK Health Radio, My Life as an Animal, written by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith.
My Life as an Animal. Not Forgetting. Sarah and I took on our first rescue dog in June 1984, the first of a total of 19 waifs who were to come our way over the next 33 years. He was a 10-year-old little gentleman with a beard and a coat that was coloured earth brown and white. He was called Oski, and everything we didn't know about dogs was inadvertently visited upon him. We walked him too often for fear of not giving him enough exercise. We threw narrow sticks and tennis balls for him to fetch, even though both can lodge in a dog's gullet, sometimes killing them. And we missed his probably frantic signalling to us that he wanted canine company after more than 3 years as the only one. We'd held off taking on another dog, thinking Oski might regard the newcomer as competition for our attention. Instead, the new dog became his long-awaited, energising playmate. Among Oski's mysterious talents was an ability to find tennis balls hidden in deep vegetation. On a walk, he would suddenly switch direction, run 50 yards into bushes, and emerge with a ball in his mouth. But however refined an instrument his nose might have been, it was not a big nose. I know this because while we were on Hampstead Heath one afternoon, a little boy, maybe 4 years old, ran up to Oski, hugged him, pulled back to study his face, and called over to us reassuringly, "He hasn't got a big nose." And it's true, he didn't have a big nose. The dog Oski fell for was just 8 or so months old when we collected her from a block of flats on the way to Camden. She was a copper and white long-haired Sheltie Terrier cross, who we called Penny, soon to be WPC Penny, because of the way she policed the heath on our daily walks. If anything struck her as being out of place, such as a car being driven across the grassy fields, she would shoot us a look that said, "Are you going to just let this happen?" When that turned out to be the case, she would sound the general alert, furious staccato barking and heavy breathing, with intermittent running back and forth. She loved nuts, we discovered one Christmas. 2 or 3 hazel or walnuts went down very well. And because we handed them to her from a wooden bowl we kept by the bookshelves in the sitting room, it was in that precise position she would sit in a stiff, obedient posture, looking expectantly at us, for a few days after Christmas was over and the nuts and the bowl had gone. Reggie, who came to us a month after we had a very old and ailing Oski euthanized, was a big-eyed, sensitive deerhound type, only considerably smaller. He was himself already old, about 11 and a half. Young Davy, Sarah's son, once inadvertently woke him while he was snoozing. He came to with a growl, primed to defend himself, and was immediately a picture of contrition, lowering his head and lifting a big front foot, his big eyes looking at each of us in turn for signs that we had forgiven him. We most certainly had. He had done nothing wrong anyway. Reggie was a superb communicator. He once hurt his foot on a walk, and the next day, when we fetched his lead for another tramp across the heath, he lifted the injured foot to show us it was sore. We congratulated him and let him rest. A while later, there was a walk he didn't fancy. It was wet and blowy, and Reggie was by then probably 12 years old. When we came to him with the lead, he solemnly lifted his foot and looked at us pleadingly. I believe he scored 50% that time. We took him on a walk, but made it a shorter one. Then came our little Manchester Terrier boy called Stanley. We'd begun, as so many doggy people do, by having clear rules about which parts of the house were for people only. No dogs on the couch, for instance. Okay, so when that broke down because we weakened, a new red line was drawn at the bedroom. Well, they could come in, but had to stay on the floor in one of several nice doggy beds we'd provided. Right, the ones who absolutely love the snug feeling of being on the bed could be there, but not under the duvet. The line had been drawn there, although when our backs are turned, they sometimes try it on. For readers who regard the above as horribly indulgent and or unhygienic, I will point out that every evening each one of the dogs is brushed and combed by Sarah, and therefore none of them had that old sock doggy smell, and fleas have no time to settle and multiply. I mention Stanley in the context of where lines are drawn, because after a week, when he'd found his feet, he suddenly objected to my getting into bed beside Sarah. He'd got there first and intended driving me away with a stern look and a sort of jabbing headbutt that must have hurt his nose. I suspect he knew there was no future in it and made way when I refused to meet the challenge and simply clambered past him. We soon became friends, and 20 years after his death, in 1998, I think of a devoted little chap for whom our family unit was something he would have defended to the death. Liam was an exceptionally handsome young dog, with coil-ringed eyes, who we found wandering lost on Hampstead Heath. We took him home and put up signs advising he'd been found, but the signs kept being taken down. Was it a misanthrope trying to sabotage a happy reunion? And then Sarah caught a woman in the act. She explained that Liam was being badly treated where he lived and said it would be a disaster to return him to that place. We kept him. He had the sweetest, most gentle nature. Although for a couple of years we worried that someone would approach us on a walk and demand the return of their dog. Katie was one of a large number of former street dogs who were brought over from Greece in 1996, paid for, I believe, by a member of European royalty, and rehomed mainly in the English southeast. She was a wanderer from the start. Initially, she'd disappear on a walk and not come back until we'd reached the car. Every day we'd do 90 minutes at one of a half a dozen locations that offered woods, lakes, fields, rivers. After a while, she stopped turning up for the car ride home. She'd return hours later, having somehow survived the murderous traffic. We began keeping her on a lead on walks that she found an especially good launch site for untethered adventures. But soon every walk tempted her. On a couple of occasions, she stayed out overnight, which was an agony to endure for Sarah and me. It was when we began to trust her again and let her run free that she disappeared for all time. We never did find out what happened to her, although I suspect that she got under the wire into a deer farm and the owner shot her, even though he denied all knowledge of her. We were desperate to find out the truth because for as long as it's an unknown, the imagination paints terrifying endings, or worst, demonic torments without end. I can't imagine what else we could have done to find her. We posted in towns and villages all around where she'd been lost. A distinctive poster Sarah made. She contacted local vets, the police and the council dog pound in case they'd seen or heard anything. She prompted local newspapers and radio to run special features. We enlisted the help of two clairvoyants, one of whom said Katie was being held captive in an isolated house close to the woods where we lost her. We made an unannounced visit and spoke to the friendly couple who lived there, who let us look wherever we wanted. And we even tramped those woods after midnight, calling her name in case she was lying injured but too scared to reveal her hiding place during the busy daylight hours. Katie was about 9 years old when she disappeared. It was another 7 or 8 years before I could put out of my mind all the dark imaginings. She would surely be dead by then and safe from human wickedness. I called her Sophie Tyler, signifying how close I got to this very special girl who was part of our family for 14 years. She came as a one-year-old via a West Country animal rights activist who saved her from being disposed of as surplus to someone's requirements. Sophie Tyler was mostly staffy, white with black patches, and had the nutty humour and barrelling physicality of a piglet in spring. Her party piece was very piglet, sprinting at full speed in a circle that took in a series of tight racing car bends and ended with a marvellously elegant three-quarters sideways somersault that was her own copyright. She was the happiest of all dogs and got on with every human or animal she encountered. But glaucoma made her blind, and although she cheerfully persisted, old age gradually stole her hearing and darkened her mood. We called in a vet to put an end to her suffering, but I wish we'd done it 2 or 3 weeks earlier. I wish that again as I write these words. There was something supernatural about the way Gus came to us. The area dog warden, Jason, had been helping us with what turned out to be a fruitless search for our Greek wanderer, Katie, when he came across a very old, aged 16 or 17, male collie, lumbering along a road by some woods, uncertain where he was. He looked as though he'd been lost for hours and maybe overnight. He was weak, scared and infested with fleas. Jason was required to take any dog he found to the council dog pound, even though he hated the thought of the old guy spending his last 2 weeks before being put down, alone in a stone cell at that loveless place. At the same time, Sarah and I were admitting to each other that Katie was unlikely ever to be found, and that it was time to do what, over the years, we'd learnt was the most practical and emotionally consoling thing: take on another dog in need. We began and ended the search at the council pound. In answer to our question, which dog is least likely to find a home, the answer was the old boy, who we ended up calling Gus. When we told dog warden Jason that we had taken on a new rescue in memory of Katie, he immediately mentioned the old collie and said he had willed it. He had focused all his mental energy on willing Sarah to take him on because, as a marketable proposition, Gus had virtually zero appeal. When we got home, Sarah tried drawing a brush through his matted fur, but it was too densely tangled. He cried all through that first night. The next day he was cleaned up and unknotted at the nearby dog beauty parlour. The night howling stopped after 3 or 4 nights, and he came to understand that he was safe and cared for by us. We gave him some good days, but after just 7 weeks, he suffered a fatal stroke. Jessie was another miserable inmate we saved from the council pound. She had the look of a whippet, though with a coat that was white with soft brown patches. None of our dogs had been as nervy and anxious as Jessie, or so thoroughly devoted to Sarah that, upon hearing her talking in the street below our first floor bedroom window one Sunday morning, she jumped out of it to be with her, landing on the tile path, her forward propulsion halted by the wooden gate. Astonishingly, nothing was broken. A while later, she collapsed on a walk and lay slumped, weak and silent, in my arms as I carried her to the car. It turned out that she had a damaged heart and was expected to live not more than 6 months, but she willed longer and had a decent quality of life for a further 18 months, at which point she went into decline and we called a vet to put an end to her suffering. Lewis was also a pound dog. He was probably just 11 or 12 months old when we took him home, but already his brow was wrinkled and worried, and it was this that won me over. I've always thought of him as a Great Dane type, though half the size and minus the teddy bear temperament. For 5 or 6 years, Lewis couldn't meet other dogs without wanting to do them serious harm. We were now living in Animal Aid's hometown of Tunbridge. I would go directly to the office while Sarah did the daily 90-minute walk with Lewis and our 4 other dogs. Weekends, we would go together. A walk with Lewis was usually darkened by his attempts to rush any dog who came into view. Sarah would be constantly checking in all directions for dog walkers and putting Lewis back on a lead when anyone was seen or heard. She would also, where possible, duck through a hedge out of sight to avoid encountering other walkers with her hysterically aggressive dog straining at the leash. All that would have been manageable, but At the same time, there was fractiousness between one of ours and a neighbour's dog, who wouldn't have got a walk had we not taken her. The stress caused by their feuding, together with Lewis's unpredictable violent impulses, eventually brought Sarah to the edge of a breakdown. I took Lewis over. It meant getting up 1 hour earlier each morning, but that would give me the chance to try out a gradualist plan for socialising Lewis. I began with him on a lead, wearing an anti-bite mask and not being allowed to meet anybody. A day or two later, he could pause, still on the lead, to meet dogs he had previously encountered and not fought with. The next stage was the same, but with the mask off. Then I dared to have him off the lead in certain locations, but with the mask on, then the same with the mask off, and so on, until, after 2 years, he was less than perfect, but considerably reformed. The sweet boy, yes, that is what he became, was our companion until just a couple of months ago, when we saw that the physical and mental infirmities of old age had squeezed all joy from him. He was 16 or 17 years old when we called in the vet. Sammy, a pretty Welsh collie, had four owners before we persuaded an erstwhile friend, who was unable to care for her properly, to leave Sammy with us. She had that collie inner toughness. Lewis tried to bully her, but she wouldn't have it, and nor would we. She was tough, but her chaotic early years left her anxious and mistrustful. She would step on a thorn, hobble over to us with the foot raised, asking us to make it better, and the moment you went to touch the sore foot, she would snarl and growl and bare her teeth. Eventually, we learnt that she really did not want to hurt us, and we carried on doing what had to be done. Sammy was our scout. In the back seat of the car, she would maintain a steely focus on the route ahead, as though her diligence was all that kept us from catastrophe. And on walks, she maintained a 360-degree watch. While for most dogs, scent is probably the most important faculty for finding their way through the world, for collies like Sammy, it is the eyes. Like Lewis, she was gradually worn away by the years. And in September 2016, the vet was called. We always had that final deed done in our home, and we leave the body where our other dogs can see that their sister, brother, is dead and didn't mysteriously disappear to who knows where. We had Sadie, our first Yorkshire Terrier, for only 15 months, but then she was 14 when we persuaded the wealthy couple who owned her to give her up. An acquaintance of the family had told us that Sadie needed rescuing because she was an irrelevance to the couple. Maybe in her earlier years, they were charmed by her, but now she was just an object, something that needed feeding. Her eyes and teeth were in a terrible condition, but with Sarah gently bathing and wiping clean her eyes every evening, the muck and discoloration gradually went and her eyesight improved. Anesthesia is risky in very old dogs, but the pain from rotting teeth makes every day a trial, a situation that can only worsen. So we went ahead with the op, from which she emerged safely, minus 12 teeth. A second Yorkie came our way just 3 months after we took on Sadie. A woman came to the animal aid office with a tiny old girl who she said had wandered into her garden. She would have kept the dog herself if circumstances made that possible. She said she had no idea to whom the Yorkie belonged, and, without ado, left the little dog and departed. That evening, Sarah and I knocked on 50 doors in the woman's neighbourhood, with the dog tucked under my arm, hoping for a positive identification, but no luck. Before starting the door-to-door, I checked out the woman's garden to see how a dog might have got in. A large, lithe dog might have been able to jump and clamber over a fence. But there was no way through for a 14-year-old Yorkshire Terrier. The woman had lied to us, a fact confirmed within days when her 8 or 9-year-old daughter called across the road to me. "Where did you get that dog, mister?" I answered something like, "I was asked to give her a home." She told her friend loud enough so that I could hear that the little dog who we had, named Lizzie, looked just like her granddad's dog. which I surmised meant that the granddad had got his daughter to call on us at Animal Aid with the bogus story. A week after that first encounter with the girl, she spotted me again, and this time was unequivocal. "That man," she shouted, "took my granddad's dog." I thought about explaining things to her, but saw only trouble down that route. Little Lizzie had a huge herniated bulge protruding through her stomach wall. It looked like part of the intestine breaking free, and there was something I hadn't noticed at first. She was giving out a little dry cough every minute or so, including through most of the night. The vet estimated her age to be 17, and although some of her multiple problems were technically treatable, she was too old and sick for any kind of remedial surgery. Cliched as it might sound, Little Lizzie was a giant personality who was part of our family for far too short a time. Just 3 weeks. I remember walking down to the office with both Sadie and Lizzie. Normally, they would have been on leads, but for part of that walk, due to Sadie's sore hip and Lizzie's looking tired, I had one tucked under each arm. A young man doing repairs to his motorbike saw me coming, smirked and said something witty to his girlfriend. Without aggression, nice and easy, I said to him, "You know, some people might look at me and think I look like a ponce. But the real ponces are the people who bought these dogs or bred them and then got bored and dumped them, leaving people like me and my wife to pick up the pieces." Neither of them spoke. But before I moved off, his girlfriend wordlessly endorsed what I had to say. It occurred to me later that a smart rejoinder from him would have been, "You do look like a ponce, mate, but nothing to do with the dogs." Liz's cough and respiratory problems got so bad we had to call in the vet. Sadie lived to the age of 15 and a half and died in my arms in July 2004. Another Yorkie arrived just 4 months after Lizzie died. Her name was Lottie. She was 4.5 years old and had been one of a dwindling number of animals cared for by an animal enthusiast in King's Lynn called Maya. It was as simple as getting on the train to King's Lynn, meeting Maya and her husband at the station, doing the Lottie handover, and spending the remaining 12 minutes before the train back to Tunbridge was due, trying to convince Maya that Lottie would be safe and happy with us. 10 minutes into the return journey, Maya called my mobile, frantic with worry. She looked so lost and confused. "No reflection on you. Perhaps I've made a mistake. I should take her back. Shall I tell you what she's doing right now?" I answered. "This lost and confused girl is flopped out in the arms of an Italian student who has fallen in love with her. In fact, every one of her 5 female friends have also been smitten. Lottie is looking blissful and couldn't be more relaxed." Something in Maya probably died a little on discovering that Lottie was not falling apart without her. I have 5 more dogs to tell you about, 3 of whom are still very much alive. Molly was 12 when she joined our family on a permanent basis. She had been claimed from a dog pound some years before by a couple who lived a dozen houses from us on the same street. Visits to the couple's family and the husband's work postings overseas meant there were frequent partings from Molly. They'd put her in commercial kennels, which would have been a miserable experience for a dog whose memories of the time spent behind bars at the local authority pound, with the pitiful nighttime wailing of distressed fellow residents, are likely to still have been vivid. Our neighbours thought they had no viable alternative to the kennels, but we convinced them to let Molly stay with us whenever they were away from home. And then came the day when the husband's job took him to California for more than 2 years. Molly was already 12 years old by then and far from healthy emotionally. Any animal she encountered, whether duck, cat, dog or sheep, she'd want to attack. She needed stability, routine and love. Resettling in California, following a 12-hour flight, would have magnified her problems. Thankfully, our neighbours agreed to leave Molly with us when they went. She was quick to settle in. The aggressive impulses gradually faded, and while she could be a tough nut in her dealings with other animals, she seemed to have a look of contentment about her. It was cancer that carried Molly off. She was 15 and had been with us for nearly 4 years.
UK Health Radio.
The station that makes you feel good.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and cream.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Two of the four remaining dogs I have yet to tell you about came from the same old lady. Mary was no longer able to walk them and had no family or friends she could rely upon. So, for some months, Sarah walked and returned them to Mary in her sheltered apartment. Then came a lengthy spell of icy weather, which turned the roads and pavements where Mary lived into an unapproachable, skiddy, frozen obstacle course. She recognised that looking after two dogs was now beyond her. The first of her pair she asked to take on was six-year-old Minnie, a lively slate-coloured Jack Russell Terrier. Minnie has loved her long walks, every minute of which she chased and explored and got up to who knows what mischief. At home, she has turned out to be a private girl, the one who holds back in a quiet part of the house when visitors come calling. She also has a charmingly enigmatic side to her. You might enter the bathroom and find her sitting there in the dark, looking rapt and attentive. Like Sophie Tyler before her, Minnie suffered glaucoma and lost the sight in one eye. She's 13 years old as I write this in 2017 and needs reassuring that all is well more than she once did. The second of Mary's pair was Sophie M., an elderly, wonky-faced Shih Tzu who came to us a month after we took on Minnie. Age 15 and in urgent need of Sarah's remedial treatment for eyes, teeth and coat, Sophie M. failed the conventional beauty test. But in the real world, she was a charismatic charmer who had strangers waiting in line to stroke her and let her know how adorable she was. Maybe it was the droopy tongue and the waggling Mae West walk. At a deeper level, she had reserves of grit and purpose that made her a survivor. Sarah would drop her off at the Animal Aid office about 9:30 every weekday morning and go on her long walk with our other dogs. I would meanwhile take Sophie M. on a half-hour progress up and down the high street where she would receive the acclaim of her public. She was to live only 9 more months, through the spring and summer of 2011, before succumbing to a stroke, but they were good sunny times for her, and for us too. Poppy is physically almost a duplicate of our Jessie, the nervous girl who jumped onto our garden path to be with Sarah. Poppy came to us via our window cleaner. He had broken up with his girlfriend and moved into a flat in which dogs were not allowed. The night he left Poppy in our care, she cried pitifully. The next day, she spent several hours monitoring the street through the large sitting room windows. Then, as is the way, her devotional love was gradually transferred to her new family. Poppy is still with us 10 years later. Incredibly, she has reached the age of 16. I say incredibly because 3 or 4 years ago, she was suffering the ravages of a multiple allergy syndrome which had brought her to the very edge of death. The skin all over her body had become a lumpy, septic mess. She was weak and ate only tiny amounts. A series of blood and other tests suggested she was allergic to an increasing number of foods and environmental pollutants. In our search for a remedy, Sarah and I had wanted to avoid going the chemical bombardment route, but reluctantly we found ourselves scrambling from antibiotics to various chemical rinses and lotions designed to kill the cell invaders. But Poppy just got sicker and weaker. Then, through someone who knew someone, we contacted a woman who reportedly had a track record of healing such problems. She was happy to help, but didn't want to meet us or be given money, and we had to follow her instructions. That meant immediately stopping all treatment and withholding food for 48 hours. Poppy's immune defenses were misfiring, she said. Her whole digestive and circulatory system were also failing because of the diet of pathogen-fighting chemicals and novel healing foods she was being fed. Her body needed to rest. It needed to rediscover its own restorative powers. After the two-day fast, she could have one small spoon of mashed potatoes, and then a little more on successive days. By the fifth day, she could have a couple of spoonfuls of Chappie canned dog food. We were skeptical but kept the faith. Gradually, variety was to be reintroduced. Well, we did all we were asked to do, Chappie included. And Poppy recovered. The multiple sensitivity syndrome was not banished, but it was certainly subdued. A happy result that had been achieved through buttressing Poppy's own biological defences. And so Poppy lives. One-eyed Minnie carries on gamely, and completing the pack is Lottie Lee, our extraordinary Brussels Griffon. Lottie Lee is the size of a broad-chested Yorkshire Terrier, and has something of a Ming dynasty emperor about her, both in appearance and natural hauteur. She is quite rightly disdainful of anyone who visits the house, her house, and sweeps past without a greeting. She'll sometimes remind them with a nip to the back of the calf, and she disdains the idea of being led around on a lead, especially because she will always walk to heel. Though bossy and self-important, she's also spirited, comical, loving and loyal. After Lewis was euthanized and we laid him out on the floor of the sitting room, it was Lottie who sat vigilant by his body, just as it was Lottie who must have one of her dog family to cuddle up with when going to bed. She used to live with a Great Dane called Jake under the roof of a good citizen called Lisa, but Lisa fell foul of the neighbors after reporting to the authorities concerns she had about the welfare of their children. The local authority did precisely what she asked them not to do, identified her as the complainant. The neighbours responded with a stream of abuse and very credible threats to her person and property. She moved out of the house and saw no option but to give up her dogs. And that's how Lottie Lee, for Lisa, came to us. And so, Oski was the first in 1984, and as I write these words 33 years later, we can look back on 18 more dogs who have shared our home. Not one of them was ever grumpy in the morning, or bad-tempered, or complained that they were bored, or that they had tripped and twisted their toe, and now it was really hurting. Whatever we did, they wouldn't judge us. I'm not sure I know of any human being with such qualities. Do you? I also remember the many injured, sick and exhausted pigeons who have passed through our house, as well as the 13 guinea pigs, 4 rats and a tortoise called Fritzy. Pigeons are noble birds who raise their young and find food and shelter, even while living amongst a congenitally hostile human population. Parents look on indulgently as young children chase and try to harm birds who come within stamping distance. The conditioning runs deep, the message being that pigeons are a social menace, a financial burden, and carriers of disease that afflict people.
On these fallacious grounds, municipal authorities shoot, poison and gas huge numbers of the birds every year. As our commitment to animal rights and welfare became known locally, people began bringing Sarah pigeons they'd found exhausted or sick, with anything from Newcastle disease to a broken wing. Some of her patients were baby squabs, still with their fluffy yellow covering. She made up special pigeon quarters in the scullery, looking out onto the garden. There were three main types of patient: the city or feral bird, descendant of cliff-dwelling rock pigeons; the wild wood pigeon, who is bigger than his feral cousin and also more resistant to being caged while healing; and the racing bird, whose powerful urge to return to his mate is exploited by a self-indulgent sporting clique. Some of the races involving British birds start in France, and that means a long, unbroken flight across the Channel, into which I've no doubt many of them plummet. By the time the exhausted survivors reach Kent, some make hard landings close enough to where we live for them to end up in Sarah's scullery hospital. As long as the birds were not too sick, they would usually recover and could be freed after a few days, or even sooner, if they just needed rehydrating, feeding and a rest. The problem came when they were making progress but getting dangerously impatient, throwing themselves against a cage. Sarah would have to release them and hope for the best. Many of her successes returned looking for food. One very sick pigeon came home to die. She flew into the scullery late one afternoon and perched high up by the boiler and pipes. By 7 a.m. the next morning, her life had given out. While most of the birds were keen to move on as soon as they were able, others lacked the confidence, or perhaps they simply didn't want to give up their cosy apartment with its guaranteed food and night safety. Brendan, a racing pigeon who came to us exhausted, stayed for 4 months before flying off. Philip, or Philly, was a feral bird who lived free with us for 6 years. I told his story in an article for Animal Aid's quarterly campaign journal, Outrage. It seemed to touch many people. You can read it in the appendix end piece. Our rats came to us in pairs. First there was Solly and Rudy, and, after old age claimed them, Chloe and Zoe. The boys were large and white and were bred to be used in laboratory experiments, but the testing company crashed financially, and it was announced that all its hundreds of animals would be humanely destroyed. The boys were saved, along with just 8 other rats, by local animal activists, who persuaded the company that releasing them would be good PR. Our boy rats were smart, gentle and handsome. Solly would sit on my shoulder while I cleaned my teeth, and he'd wrestle me for coloured pens. Chloe and Zoe had been with an army man who said he had to give them up due to an overseas posting. Their fur was brown. They were half the boy's size, but they would bite your fingers whenever they could, although as they got older, they were more inclined to forgive our forwardness. Our guinea pigs generated oceans of pee and enough of the hard brown stuff to fertilise a dozen fields of corn. There were 13 of them over 5 years. Sarah constructed their elaborate housing using mostly cardboard boxes. It occupied a third of our sitting room, and each day she cleaned it out afresh. Of those I clearly recall, there is Nellie, so named because of her large elephant-shaped ears, and there is Nervous Petra, Glamorous Lana, and Sweet Chips, who, in his previous life, had stupidly been bought from a pet shop as a gift for a 3-year-old boy. The child, of course, was soon bored with the wriggly novelty which made Chips instantly disposable. Via a mutual friend, he ended up in our front room, sharing the enclosure with 3 girl guineas. That's after we'd taken the precaution of having him neutered. An inadvertent boost to our guinea pig numbers came after we told an animal rights friend who was homing unwanted guineas that we had room for one more. She pressed us into taking 2. But one of them was pregnant and, within days, had delivered 3 babies. Fritzy the tortoise was just a few months old when she was offered for sale from an East London street market stall,
It was 1970, and her new owner, a 30-year-old bank telephonist, was to demonstrate over the next 25 years that she knew nothing, or perhaps cared nothing, about what a tortoise needs for a reasonable life. When we first heard about Fritzi, through the woman's daughter, she was no longer being fed, and her housing was a cardboard box, not much bigger than she was. Even though we laid on wholesome food and textbook accommodation, years of neglect meant she was never robustly healthy and always needed encouragement to eat. An example of the neglect she suffered became startlingly apparent one April Saturday morning when, after much straining and twisting, she shat out a scarily large volume of fur and a piece of sharp glass-like plastic. She'd probably eaten this pile of lethal garbage during those desperate times she wasn't being fed. Fritzi had been with us for 5 years before the fur and glass were expelled. Everything about a tortoise is slow. The time it takes to show symptoms of illness, the slow road to recovery, and dying itself. On another level, Fritzi was uncomplicated. She would express how she felt by seeking you out to snuggle up and be warm together. And when you looked into her eyes, she would unabashedly meet and hold your gaze. Fritzi lived with us for 17 years altogether and was probably getting on for 45 when, during her annual hibernation, she died. I hope the balance of her life was positive. We have to hope that for all the animals who have passed through our hands.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living. We've been doing this for over 40 years. Every year, more and more people are living satisfying lives completely cruelty-free. Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Postscript. Dying with Dignity by Sarah Starkey. In 2015, Andrew first made contact with Dignitas in Switzerland. He knew that his health was deteriorating fast, not only his Parkinson's, but also the severe degenerative disease in his back. By early 2017, it was time to enforce the plan for a dignified end. In a letter he wrote for friends to read after his death, though he changed his mind and decided to send it a few days before, Andrew explained that, "For nearly 2 years, I haven't been able to do that simplest of things, sit up in bed with a book. What I don't want above all, and who does," he added, "was to slide into what ultimately awaits many Parkinson patients, being a helpless, immobile, drooling shadow of what I was, unable to speak or think properly." After stringent checks by Dignitas and independent Swiss doctors and emotional farewells to friends, family, neighbours and colleagues, we left for Switzerland on Wednesday 26th of April. Andrew ended his life 2 days later. That same evening I returned to England, accompanied by my dear friend Jilly. The following morning, I felt the need to try and explain the whole experience to all those who had shown such love and concern for Andrew, and so I put together the following open letter. Got back last night, 8 p.m, Friday. I'm crying as I write this. You hold it together and then pow. Andrew, resolute to the end, showed no fear, no weeping or wailing, just so pleased that the wonderful people of Dignitas exist and we were lucky enough to be in a position to use them. We flew out on Wednesday. Our wonderful and generous friends, Jilly and David, paid for us to go business class in the front row so Andrew could stretch his legs. The hotel was just perfect. There are going to be a lot of perfects in this letter. Our room large and clean, with sitting room area, a balcony, and a top-of-the-range bathroom. We were lucky to have been told of a vegan veggie restaurant, the oldest in Zurich, just a 10-minute cab ride away. Andrew felt confident to go as we had bought, in the UK, a stroller mobility frame that allowed him to push and keep his balance. It also had a seat to perch on should he need it. Well, the restaurant was everything we could wish for. Funky, cool, lively, efficient, and with lovely staff. Oh yes, and the food was delicious too. A hot and cold buffet with a choice of perhaps 100 or more dishes. The place is so renowned that it's always packed with lively people of all ages. We ate both nights there, overeating and enjoying the atmosphere. Hiltl, as it is called, turns out to be the world's oldest vegetarian restaurant, according to the Guinness Book of Records, dating back to 1898. It is now owned by a fourth generation of the Hiltl family, who also own Switzerland's first veggie butcher, situated just around the corner. So our stay really was perfect. We couldn't have struck luckier. Andrew was on top form, making me laugh a lot with his quick wit and sharp mind. His quips made me giggle a great deal. For example, on Thursday night, I decided to set the alarm. Why, I have no idea, as I wake around crack of dawn. And Andrew said, "Let's set the alarm nice and early so we can get in plenty of crying." That tickled my fancy. Now to why we were there. A sweet young doctor came to our hotel early evening on Wednesday to discuss and confirm that Andrew really meant what he was about to do. He had assessed Andrew's request for an assisted death, including medical reports given to Dignitas. He came again on Thursday to reaffirm that Andrew meant it. The law in Switzerland demands this. The doctor then wrote the prescription for the lethal medication, and Dignitas procured it ready for Andrew's arrival. On Friday we ate, or rather Andrew ate, a hearty breakfast. At 9:30 a.m. our darling friend Julie arrived in a taxi from the airport. She left Heathrow at 6 a.m. to catch the flight out, and the three of us were driven on to Dignitas itself, some 30-odd minutes away in the countryside. The building is hidden away on a small industrial estate adjacent to fields and forest. The reason for this is that the Swiss authorities do not want Dignitas in a residential area. Inside, however, the place had been turned into a light and airy home from home. Two very caring people, both in their mid-70s, I would imagine, greeted us. They were very calm and gentle, and they once again asked if Andrew was absolutely sure. Without hesitation, he said a curt and concise yes. We signed a few forms. We had done tons of detailed ones over the months in correspondence with Dignitas, as required by them, doctors who work with them, and the Swiss authorities. And we talked for a few minutes. Andrew was given an antiemetic to ensure that he wouldn't be sick when he took the fatal dose. And we were left for as long as we wanted in private. The three of us had spent so many times and hours together that we said 10 minutes would be fine. We took a couple of photos of Andrew, me, and the two attendants, whose names I will keep to myself. And then I did the same with Jilly included. Andrew was asked to sit on the bed and he drank the barbiturate dose around 11 a.m. Soon he was drifting off, and then he fell into a coma. But it wasn't until 3:10 p.m. that he was actually pronounced dead. As frail as he had become, his heart and character remained strong. I'm so glad he's in no pain anymore, and being the person he is, he never once in 10 years of this disease said, "Why me?" In truth, he rarely complained of the pain at all, even though it was constant. Gilly and I feel privileged to have been there with this man who was so brave and calm right to the end. He didn't even cry, unlike Gilly and me, though we did hold it together most of the time. Andrew had said to me a few times that he wanted to say, "This stuff tastes awful. What are you trying to do, kill me?" when he was drinking the barbiturate. But he didn't know whether he'd be able to when the time actually arrived. This made me laugh. But I said, "You can't say that." As he drifted off, he told one of the attendants that he'd thought of saying it. So in fact, he did manage it. I can't remember if she smiled, but Gilly and I certainly did. Gilly was my rock coming home. I had intended travelling alone, refusing help from my dear friend Bethan, who had offered so willingly to help me when she first guessed what was happening, but I was convinced I could handle it by myself. Thank you, Bethan, for thinking sensibly, even if I didn't. One day, much, much nearer the time, Gilly was here talking to Andrew, and both of them put their foot down and insisted. Thank you, Gilly, wise, sensible woman. Lovely David, her sweet, kind husband, was waiting for us at the airport, and we came home to son Davy, the dogs, and an open fire. Ellie, Davy's girlfriend, had been staying too, but had decided that Davy and I needed time together. She also needed to get home to sort her own sorrow out. Davy says what a comfort she had been and what an essential part she had played, being here with him while we were in Switzerland. She also had made and left a delicious leek and potato soup, just perfect warming comfort food for such a time. Thank you, Davy and Ellie, for keeping my beloved dogs content and secure while we were gone. Davy has found all this just as hard as I have. You think, well, we've had, in my case, 2 years, and in Davy's around one, to come to terms with this. But real life and emotions get in the way, and all your reasoned arguments still don't stop you wanting it not to be the way it is. What I can't get over is the absolute love and devotion that so many, many people have shown the last few days before going, when folks started being told and were coming around to say goodbye to Andrew, or sending messages both here and to Switzerland, would have sent most people into a mad spin. But Andrew kept cool and was just so sorry he was making so many people cry. We were also very thrilled that no one questioned the logic of it. Of course, everyone was stunned, as Nick, Andrew's brother, said, and needed a day or two to get their heads around it. Everyone is sad, but understanding of why this is what Andrew did. What every one of us has to remember is that Andrew is really happy that what he has done is absolutely the right thing. And I was so lucky to see his suffering go away. And he was determined to go on his feet, and he did.
That was My Life as an Animal by Andrew Tyler and read by Jim Smith. Produced by Tom Davidson and adapted for UK Health Radio by Monkey Nut Audiobooks. My Life as an Animal is available on Audible and audiobook sites. Be sure to tune in next time to hear more from this title. This audiobook is published by Monkey Nut Audiobooks in Hampshire, UK.